Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today's guest is Hunter Baker, Associate Professor of Political Science and the Dean of Instruction at Union University. He is the author of three books, The End of Secularism, Political Thought, A Student's Guide, and most recently, The System Has a Soul, Essays on Christianity, Liberty, and Political Life. The latter is a compendium of a number of essays Hunter has written over the years. Hunter has been a guest on this show twice before, talking about his scholarship on secularism, as well as his reflections on Christian higher education. We always link back to those previous discussions, the books written by our guests, plus a few more exciting tidbits, so please feel free to browse our website, including our 200-plus archived interviews. There's bound to be something there for everybody, so please tell a friend about our show as well. I should also note that Professor Baker and his wonderful family are also companions of a brand new chocolate Labrador puppy. Yay! Hunter, welcome back to Research on Religion, and how is that puppy working out for you?
Well, I guess I regret to say that we don't have that puppy to which you refer. When my children listen to this interview, if they do, I'll have to squelch the excitement that comes about when you make the statement about the puppy, and then I'll be a very popular guy.
Oh, yeah. Hey, kids, the puppy is behind the closet door in the front hall. Oh, yeah. No, I've been teasing Hunter here about getting a puppy. He's thinking about getting another kitten, but we are dog families here on Research on Religion. If you listen closely, every so often you'll hear Rocky Barkington, the official Research on Religion mascot. So,
I want to say, I don't know if there's any human being alive who enjoys having a dog more than you do.
Dogs are great. You got to get a dog because they make the world a better place. That's what they do. Anyways,
they're like the saints of the animal kingdom, right?
They are the saints of the animal kingdom. So more dogs equals less conflict. I will tell you that. Anyways, we're not here to talk about puppies or golden retrievers or anything like that. We are here to talk about your book, The System Has a Soul. And I want to start off here by asking you why the title of that book. That almost sounds like a album from the Police or a new rock group, The System Has a Soul. What provoked that title?
Well, some years ago I was asked to give a series of endowed lectures at Southern Seminary. I'm not a seminarian, but I was asked to give these lectures, and that was the title that just kind of came to mind. I think that it comes from sort of my view of the proper relationship between church and state. You know, some people when they want to draw, I actually approve very strongly of the separation of church and state, but I don't agree that separating church and state means secularism. What I think it means is that there's institutional independence between the two, but for me, the ideal kind of role for the church is to act as a kind of a conscience, or, as I say, a soul for the system.
Actually, that's a very good observation. This is one that I've made for a long time. I know a number of atheist commentators and people who favor secular politics often say that the separation of church and state should lead to the extrication of religion from politics. But I have noted that actually it's quite the opposite. The more you separate church and state, the more likely you are to get religious influence in politics, because religious institutions, organizations, and individuals become very active and become a conscience. They feel that they can speak out because they're not somehow tied to the state and would be punished by loss of budget or something. I mean, if you look at Europe, they don't have very much religion influencing their politics, or so they say, but the churches there, a lot of them are just extensions of the bureaucracy in several places.
That's exactly right. I can't remember if we talked about it in our first podcast, but in the first book, The End of Secularism, I refer to that arrangement, in some countries where you have, instead of a church, you have a Department of God, basically.
That's a great way of saying that. I might have to crib that for some of my future writings. But as I tell people, is if you want to get religion out of politics, make it an agency of the state, right? Make it the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah. Fund it.
Yeah. But we are talking about the system having a soul, and that's largely a bunch of reflections of political life, and it covers a wide range of issues, mostly here in the United States. And you take on topics such as the morality of capitalism, the nature of religious liberty in our society, and you also touch upon some social issues such as abortion and gay marriage. Now, we're not necessarily here to nitpick those particular issues, but rather I thought our discussion should center on the role of the religious right in America over the past half century or so, because a lot of the aforementioned topics are of particular concern to that demographic or to that group of folks, the religious right. Yeah. So in essence, we're here to put a lot of the saliency of those issues, things that people love to talk about, into a historical context and examine the ups and downs and possibly even the turnarounds of what is loosely known as the religious right and the various personalities who have shaped and inhabited that movement. So you all set to do that?
Yes.
All right. Let's start off with this concept of the religious right, and I'm using air quotes. You can't see that right now, but when I say religious rights, I have those little fingers up in the air doing that. And I guess we need a definition of what the religious right is. How would I know a member of the Christian right if they were walking, or the religious right, I should say, if they were walking down the street? Do they wear polyester and have big hair? What's the deal?
Yeah, I guess if we want to be funny about it, we could imagine somebody who looked like an engineer at Intel circa 1974. polyester slacks, short-sleeved dress shirt, very narrow tie. But that is not what a member of the religious right looks like. They're probably not all that distinguishable from everyone else, which might come as a surprise because you think about when there first started to be a lot of coverage about the religious right, it was probably the 1980s. And I think particularly about a story in the Washington Post that described members of the religious right as poor, uneducated, and easy to command. It's sort of like Jane Goodall reporting on the chimpanzees or something, gorillas in the mist or something. I'm not sure how those impressions were formed or how rigorous the reporter's study of these people was. Members of the religious right are like everybody else, except that they tend to have a particular set of fairly firm commitments to which they adhere.
And what would be the parameters of those commitments if we could define them?
Well, I think that we have to look at it in terms of both words, religious and right. Religious. When you're talking about the religious right, you're typically talking about people who are serious about their faith. People who tend to have a high view of Scripture, people who are frequent church attenders, who are there probably at least once a week or certainly multiple times a month, people who believe that their faith should affect their view of many different parts of life, certainly inclusive of politics, and the part where we use the word right, they have tended to form a conservative coalition aimed particularly at the reform or preservation of certain cultural stances.
Now, is that largely cultural stances in the form of what we would call social issues, or do they also have an economic conservative slant? Some people would say free market slant.
I think that the economic side of it is kind of optional.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they have tended to be to have a free market slant, if only because It has been the Republican Party that sort of welcomed, and even then kind of an uneasy welcome, but have sort of, that's been the place where members of the religious right have gathered. And I think that that the free market approach has sort of just been kind of an optional add-on to their more core concerns, which have revolved around, originally, or mostly around the pro-life issue.
And I think that's going to set up a tension here in the Republican Party as we talk about it later on, because there is
certainly a
tension between free market advocates and some of these folks advocating for various social issues, which oftentimes involve government intervention or protection of things. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But what about the history of this thing? You mentioned that the term religious right was bandied about quite a bit in the 1980s, but they did not all of a sudden appear on January 1st, 1980. How deep in history does this movement go back?
Well, it's kind of a difficult question. Now, if we want to go back and look at Christians who are very serious about politics, particularly in America, we can find a lot of people like that. Certainly the abolitionists, many of the abolitionists would fit that mold. Or if you were to look at the, one of the first presidents of Wheaton University, he would be a person who would have some very serious political commitments. What's different, though, is that these would not necessarily be commitments that would be seen necessarily as being on the right, right? They would cover a broader spectrum. So I think that when we, if you look at the, if I try to outline the trajectory of the current religious right, you might want to kind of start by looking at the Scopes trial, and not because evolution is the overriding concern, but I think sort of that helps us to understand the development. I think that with the Scopes trial, you had what appeared to be just kind of this very decisive victory for people of a more secular mindset over people like William Jennings Bryan, who is actually, politically a progressive, but a victory over people like him who applied their faith very, very seriously to their politics. And so I think the feeling was that those people had been banished, and that henceforth the modern settlement would be that, yes, you're free to be religious, but that generally speaking you're not going to mix your different worlds. You're not going to mix your politics with your faith. You're not going to mix your business with your faith. And I think that to many people, and certainly to people in the media, that appeared to be how things were settled out. I think that it came as a surprise to these folks when in the 70s and 80s, suddenly you saw this kind of very big reappearance of people who did want to mix their faith and politics, and those are the folks who have come to be known as the religious right. Now, just to, I think that the religious right is partly a product of very intentional effort among evangelicals. If you look at somebody like Carl F. H. Henry, he wrote, I think this was in the either late 40s or early 50s, The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism. Modern Fundamentalism. And he was basically arguing that it's silly that we are obsessed with things like, are men and women swimming in the same pool together? Or is anyone drinking any alcohol? Or is anyone dancing or playing cards? When really, if we have a disciplined and serious Christian faith, we should be applying ourselves to the racial question, to questions of labor and capitalism. He was basically saying you actually can't do this kind of compartmentalization. And so I think that you look at somebody like Carl F. H. Henry, and his concerns sort of eventually bear fruit in the religious right later on.
When is Carl Henry writing? The Scopes trial, let's just back up for folks not all that familiar with it, that was in the 1920s, correct?
Yes.
And so you have you know, that emerging, this is the time of progressive era in the United States. And you mentioned William Jennings Bryan, very progressive, but then a defender of, you know, preaching creation in public schools. And you got the Scopes trial coming out of this. And then you have the Great Depression. And obviously everybody's thinking about, hey, let's just get a job. And then World War II is coming. Where does Carl Henry fit into this picture? When's he writing?
He is part of a group of people who were referred to at the time as the neo-evangelicals. Neo-evangelicals kind of rose out of the fundamentalist movement. And so, you know, probably if we wanted to say kind of who are the two big, big names among the neo-evangelicals, we would pick people like Billy Graham and Carl F. H. Henry. So, you know, starting to kind of develop, you know, post-World War II, basically, and then exerting a very powerful influence throughout the second half of the 20th century.
Okay, so we're talking Henry is really active here in the 1950s-ish.
Yes, and continuing. He has been a touchstone for evangelicals for a long time. And if you look at various institutions, there will be these Carl F. H. Henry Institutes, things like that. He was also involved in prison fellowship with Chuck Colson.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then bring us up to date here. We're, you know, 1960s, 1970s, you have Carl F. Henry writing, you have Billy Graham emerging. It just seems like, you know, some religious folks getting active. When does this religious right movement start to gel into the form that we see in the 1980s?
Yeah, I think that what happens, there's basically the 70s are very important here. Now, you know, one thing you might think about is Jimmy Carter being elected president in 1976. Now, we certainly, you know, we don't tend to think of him as kind of a religious conservative hero of any sort, but he came to office with some of those hopes. In fact, if you go back, I believe you'll see that Pat Robertson supported Jimmy Carter for president. That may come as a shock to people now, but I'm fairly certain he did. And you also look at Chuck Colson. Chuck Colson, he went to jail, you know, in the early to mid 70s, came out and wrote this massive bestseller, Born Again, about his conversion to Christianity. And, you know, you need to understand, this is a guy who was a hard-bitten, tough, political, you know, operator.
Yeah, explain why he went to prison. I think that's a very important part of the story that also relates to the Jimmy Carter and then political movement of the religious right as well.
Well, he was one of Richard Nixon's main men. Now, you know, the question of why he went to prison, that's actually, you probably could argue that he shouldn't have gone to prison. You probably could argue that he didn't do anything that was strictly illegal. But he kind of chose to in fact, if you read Born Again, he sort of presents the prosecution with the theory upon which to prosecute him. I think it was an obstruction of justice charge, mm-hmm. ultimately, that he went in on.
Related to Watergate?
Actually, I think it was not directly related to Watergate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think it may have been something else, maybe to do with the Pentagon Papers, you know, something like that.
Okay, but it was during that whole period of the 70s, the Nixon political machine was looking very corrupt, and then, you know, 1976, everybody looks at Jimmy Carter saying, ah, here's somebody with a religious soul, let's purify politics in many ways.
That's right, and, you know, something that's really interesting to note, if you go back and read Born Again, some of the people who embraced Colson when he became, you know, to use the parlance of today, when he became an out Christian, you know, when he had this big spiritual conversion, people who embraced him, many of them were Democrats. You know, I think it was a senator. Oh gosh, I'm struggling to remember the guy's name. Democratic senator, I think from Iowa. Who just embraced him. And, you know, at that point, if you were to go back to the Washington of the 1970s, you would probably find as many born-again Christians, you know, really serious, devoted born-again Christians, among the Democrats as you would among the Republicans, maybe even more. So that's something that has really changed since that time. And, you know, and maybe part of that is because of the religious right. It may have caused people to kind of choose sides.
Mm-hmm. So what is going on here then? We're in the 70s. We're in Jimmy Carter, Chuck Colson's writing. You got Billy Graham on the ascendancy. You mentioned this Carl Henry. How does this start all sifting out in the 1980s?
Well, the key figure who is yet to be mentioned, you know, I mentioned Colson and Jimmy Carter. The person we haven't talked about is Francis Schaeffer. And I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with Schaeffer, but he was originally a Presbyterian youth pastor in St. Louis, and I think ultimately became a pastor. Always had this powerful social conscience. You know, as a young man, he was sort of pro-labor. You know, there's a story about how he rallied with women in a factory to strike. I think he is known for having told his congregation in St. Louis that if they were to act in a negative way on for racial reasons toward people, that he would leave the church and have nothing to do with it. So he always had this kind of strong social conscience, and he went away to Europe as a missionary, and ultimately had this this amazing ministry called Labri in Switzerland. And college students and many others, you know, Schaeffer had children, and college students and others just came through Labri for years and years. I think this goes between maybe the late 50s through the 60s, probably on into the 70s. Labri probably went on as long as he was alive, and in fact still continues. And many people came through there, and listening to these college students, he became very aware of kind of what was in the mind of the European college student at that time. And he developed arguments in the course of talking to them. And so he became very famous. He started giving these lectures that people were paying a lot of attention to. If you look at, like, Wheaton in the 1960s, you know, you'll see him going through there with a lot of fanfare, a lot of students paying attention to what he had to say. I think James Sire of Ivy Press ended up taking a lot of Schaeffer's lectures and turning them into some of the books that we're familiar with now, things like He Is There and He Is Not Silent, or The God Who Is There, or Escape from Reason, How Shall We Then Live? I was thinking of the Colson Tribute volume for Schaeffer. But anyway, what the really big splash that Schaeffer made in the 70s is that he was the first big evangelical, at least that I can think of, who was powerful on the pro-life cause. People kind of forget that leading up to Roe v. Wade, the only people that are really, really fighting the pro-life cause, you know, really advocating for it, are Catholics. The Catholic Church is in there swinging away. But, you know, you could find statements from big evangelical Baptist preachers from that time, you know, kind of more or less okay with Roe v. Wade. You know, they're probably thinking that if, you know, some parishioner's daughter gets in trouble, better just to let it be taken care of, right? So the Catholics were in there, and then Schaeffer comes in. And Schaeffer really rallied the conscience of evangelicals with regard to the sexual revolution, with regard to things like abortion. And, you know, and he was a special person because he was the kind of guy who would listen to people like the hippies. And he would say things like that the hippies actually have the right diagnosis. They realize that there's something deeply wrong with our society. It's just that they have the prescription wrong. And he thought that this gets into the free market stuff. Not that he wasn't a free market guy, but he would say that one of our problems is we're addicted to our personal peace and affluence, and that's why we don't care about some of these social issues.
It's very interesting to think about how we view the religious right now, and it's a caricature of the 1980s and how it came to emerge. Is that you do see these very social conscience folks, people marching in the civil rights movement and hanging out with hippies, all of a sudden becoming part of this distinct movement that is really going to separate itself out and drift into the Republican Party later on. And it's a lot of people don't know that history.
No, that's right. That's quite right.
So what else is occurring here? Francis Schaeffer catches the attention of evangelicals. You have people like Chuck Colson. What effect did Chuck Colson have on individuals? You mentioned that he wrote a book, but, okay, so a lot of people write a book.
I think that, first of all, I think that that book was had a powerful impact on people. I think it helped people to see that a very prominent and well-known person, somebody from this kind of, Atlantic seaboard nexus of power, could actually be a very dedicated and public Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you get into the 70s, probably the ideal is more of the, you don't ever mix religion and politics. It's kind of impolite to talk about your religion over dinner. Kind of a a very segmented sort of an approach, and in the essay that I have in this book, I talk about Colson as a guy who, and I don't know if he would have put it this way, but I think his career after the White House was kind of a crusade against functional differentiation.
Oh, whoa, what does that mean? That's a very academic term. Functional differentiation.
I think your listeners know what functional differentiation is.
Yeah, but I don't. So explain it to me.
Well, it's just one of the components of the theory of secularization. The idea that the activities of life kind of have their own logic, and they don't need to have some sort of overarching religion or morality governing them.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not religion. And I think that Colson was one of these guys who actually said no. The lordship of Christ is actually important to all of these things.
So before it was, you go to Sunday services, and that's where you do your religious thing, and then on Monday you wake up and you do your business thing, and then you come home at 5 p.m. and do the family thing. But he's saying, no, all these things are intertwined.
That's right.
Okay.
And that was Schaefer's message, too.
Why do they use the term functional differentiation? They could explain that so much easier. You academics, you drive me crazy.
Well, Tony, when I'm talking to you, I'm always talking to this guy who has these big, important books. I'm trying to impress you.
I know. That is impressive. Anything with T-I-O-N always impresses me. So, okay, so Colson is bringing this stuff together, says, okay, you got to put all this stuff together. Schaeffer is bringing, new influences about the pro-life movement. You obviously have Roe v. Wade, which becomes a seminal marker point in sifting out people. Are you on this side or on that side? What else is happening then? I mean, because we now think about the religious right mostly in the 1980s, as you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, and the folks that pop in your mind, initially are Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. They seem to be the rally around the religious right flag kind of folks. So what's going on here?
Yeah, and I want to point out, I think that people like Schaeffer and Colson probably had an impact on the thinking of a person like Jerry Falwell. Because if we were to look at Falwell, I think in the 60s, he would preach a sermon basically arguing that a pastor should never use his pulpit to talk about either racial issues or the Cold War. That these sort of political issues, that's not what we're about. You shouldn't mix politics with a time to talk about scripture. That was kind of the way he went about things. And you think about this as the guy who who founded the Moral Majority. That's kind of shocking, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He changed his view. He came around to this more holistic worldview that that your faith has an impact on everything, and certainly your political life as a citizen. And so Falwell and Robertson both became guys who started to argue in this way. Falwell with the Moral Majority, and then Robertson with the Christian Coalition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, one question I have to ask here, you mentioned that the Catholics were very involved in the pro-life movement. They were the ones actually pounding the drums in the 1960s and then early 1970s, and evangelicals came on board later on. Nowadays, we associate the religious right as being largely the evangelical Christian right. That's how people tend to view it. But is this only a movement that encompassed evangelicals? Was it one that was just taken over by evangelicals, or did this involve other Christian faiths, mainline Protestants or Catholics, or even outside the Christian family, such as Jews or other folks?
Well, certainly the dream of the, I mean, I think that the reason that Falwell named his organization the Moral Majority was that he had this dream of it consisting of conservative Christians, conservative Jews, you know, maybe even conservative Muslims, any people of faith who had kind of this traditional moral vision. I think that he hoped that they could all come together into kind of a semi-irresistible coalition. So I think that was the goal. And, you know, it's, I think about before 9/11, one of my favorite authors, Boston University professor Peter Kreeft, he wrote a book that had the now kind of unfortunate name Cultural Jihad. And I think it was an attempt to make the argument for bringing together Christians and Muslims and other folks into this kind of coalition. Now, you know, all kinds of things have happened that have fractured any notion of going that way with it. But certainly that has been the hope. Now, what has it actually achieved? The religious right is definitely not, definitely does not only consist of conservative evangelicals. There are some folks from the main line there. Definitely, I mean, conservative Catholics to me are just flat out part of the religious right. Now, you know, and people, a lot of times people will reject that characterization just because it has such a negative association in terms of kind of our popular culture in the press. But the religious right coalition is basically conservative Protestants and conservative Catholics, and, you know, a certain number of people still in the mainline church and some conservative Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you pointed something interesting out when we were talking about doing this podcast over the past week and emailing back and forth. One of the things, and I didn't know about this because I don't read Time magazine, but the folks at Time magazine actually mentioned Richard John Neuhaus as being one of the most influential evangelicals. And you kind of,
that's right.
Raw? I mean, so it's this kind of blurring of lines here, right? What was the deal with that? I mean,
well, I mean, you're exactly right, and you know that some people kind of made fun of that when it happened. I think that what it shows, I mean, to me, if you were to ask somebody in the media today, what is an evangelical? I think they think that's just any person who is really serious about their faith. I think that's what they think an evangelical is. Now, of course. Neuhaus was a former, you know, he had been up till probably the late 80s, early 90s, somewhere in there. Neuhaus had been a conservative Lutheran. I think he had been a Missouri Synod Lutheran, and he converted to Catholicism. Neuhaus alone is a very interesting figure. Neuhaus is a guy who was kind of part of Martin Luther King Jr.'s inner circle, I believe. I think that he marched with Martin Luther King. He's a lifelong friend of Peter Berger, the sociologist, the very famous sociologist. And Neuhaus did not have this kind of super strong conservative brand at all. You know, at one time, he would have been, he could, at, Robbie George gives a talk where he kind of talks about how Newhouse could have been kind of the go-to guy for the American media on religion. You know, that he could have been, he could have been like Niebuhr, you know, Reinhold Niebuhr, somebody like that. But because he became dedicated, very dedicated to the pro-life cause, I think that Newhouse lost that opportunity. But despite that, he became just an incredible influence on conservative Christians, particularly people who are you know, fairly well educated. He became a big influence on, I guess, what we might call elites within the religious right.
Mm-hmm. And who are these elites, and what is happening in the 80s and 90s? Because if you talk to people about the heyday of the religious right, again, Falwell and Robertson always pop up. Those are the ones that are on TV quite a bit. But, you know, these folks in the background, the Richard John Newhouse, the Francis Schaeffer, and other folks, they're the intellectuals behind this movement. What happens in the 80s and then in the 90s with this movement in terms of its intellectual shift or intellectual changes, if any, occur?
Well, in the 80s, you this coalition becomes a Republican coalition, for sure. You know, a lot of that is because you take somebody like Ronald Reagan. Reagan very famously spoke to a lot of these people in the religious right, and he said in a public gathering, "You can't endorse me." You know, kind of, he's acknowledging that they're pastors and, you know, nonprofit figures. "You can't endorse me, but I endorse you." So he was a public figure who welcomed their support, and they returned the favor. They supported him and have been you know, maybe the most reliable part of the Republican coalition ever since that time. But the 80s is a time of building the movement. The moral majority failed, but the Christian coalition rose, became significantly more influential, I think, than the moral majority ever had been. You go into the 90s and conservative Christians start being interested in kind of think tank activity and lobbying activity. They built organizations in probably all of the 50 states designed to affect what's going on in state capitals and to have an impact on politics.
This is an interesting shift, because, again, you know, people think that, well, the religious right went away when Bill Clinton was elected. And, you know, the moral majority by, I think, 1990, maybe 1989, no longer is in existence. But it moves in different directions. Actually, interestingly enough, it goes from the, you know, being on splashed across TV all the time down to a more grassroots activist level.
Yeah, that's for sure. And you know, we talked about the moral majority and the Christian coalition. One that I haven't mentioned yet, and that actually I think was more influential and bigger than either one of those, James Dobson.
Mm-hmm.
James Dobson, with the Focus on the Family broadcast, that broadcast was listened to by millions and millions of people. They had a huge department, you know, that just kind of dealt with the correspondence from the people who listened to that show. And Dobson... Dobson was a different figure. You know, this is a guy who had his PhD. I think he was a child psychologist, but his career had been with the USC Medical School. Maybe the USC Hospital. But see, he had a very, very significant kind of a job and career. And just felt drawn to start speaking what he saw as the truth about the family, and that broadcast. You know, he left his, you know, amazingly good kind of establishment job and career to do that. So here's a guy who was not, you know, a preacher. He was a guy who was, you know, had a very respected, esteemed sort of a, as I call it, establishment job, and he left it to pursue Focus on the Family, which ultimately grew into a massive organization. Definitely, I think that in terms of employees, budget, it had to be bigger than the Moral Majority or the Christian Coalition or anything else. You know, they still have very significant headquarters in Colorado Springs. And they when I talk about these groups in every state around the country, probably many of the ones that have been most enduring in terms of their work have actually been the ones planted by Focus on the Family.
Mm-hmm. So going kind of on the grassroots. The interesting thing, you mentioned that James Dobson had a PhD, and this, you know, goes in many ways counter to the image that was mentioned at the beginning of the podcast here, which, you know, they're all a bunch of southern white uneducated morons and things like that. But you're talking, you know, some pretty hefty intellectuals that are influencing this and making connections with everyday people. I mean, not everybody has a PhD, but, you know, when a PhD like Dobson or Schaefer or somebody speaks, these people connect with that.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, I think that's part of Schaefer's impact is that I think that he probably influenced a lot of people who now are Christian academics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, Tony, you're kind of an opponent of intellectual snobbery.
Yeah.
And I join you in that. One of the things that kind of irritates me is that Schaefer, you know, my friend Greg Thornberry, he will say, he's the president of King's College in New York, he will say things like, you know, Schaefer was the gateway drug for all of us. And there's some truth to that. What bothers me is that now, you know, a lot of people, they just love to talk about how, you know, well, Schaefer was wrong in his view of Aquinas, or Schaefer is wrong in his view of Kierkegaard. And, you know, and I'm kind of like, that misses the point. You know, Schaefer was not an academic, actually. You know, he's a guy, he was a pastor, theologian, who he listened to the things that young people were saying, and he learned how to talk to them. He learned how to address their concerns, and it you know, grew into this just amazing impact on American life and politics. And we want to kind of sit here and deconstruct him, but the reality is, I think his achievement is sort of unquestionable.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I want to talk about now is how the movement is developing in the contemporary era. A lot of these names that we've talked about, Chuck Colson, I mean, he passed away, I think, about 2 years ago. Jerry Falwell passed away about 5, 6, 7 years ago. These folks are getting older. And is there any new generation that is replacing them? And then here's the other interesting question. We see this rise of a new conservative populist movement in the Tea Party. A lot of people are talking about this, and do we see any connections between the religious right and the Tea Party, and is there a new generation of leaders carrying this movement forward, or is we just seeing the passing of the religious right now?
You know, first of all, I want to say something connected. You were talking about when was kind of the peak mm-hmm. for the religious right, and I want to give kind of a little bit of a counter intuitive answer to that.
Okay.
You know, did it end with Clinton? I actually think that the peak of the influence of religious conservatives is probably about 2005. I think that's when it got about as high as it's ever been. and I think that two things destroyed that. First of all, I think that religious conservatives were overwhelmingly identified with George W. Bush and his presidency. And I think that when the adventure in Iraq and Afghanistan began to be seen as a very significant failure, I think that that was very costly to him and to the people who were seen as kind of his core coalition. And I think that the other thing that has really damaged the standing of religious conservatives in America today has been the ascendancy of gay marriage and of a particular view of homosexuality. I can remember in the late 1990s, I was with Prison Fellowship, and we were lobbying for religious freedom legislation. And the interesting thing is that there was one group that was very prominently opposing our efforts, and that was the Human Rights Campaign, which was a which was and is a gay rights organization, and they perceived religious freedom as a threat to their own agenda. And it's just a very interesting shift. You know, if you look at the passage of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in the early 90s, passed almost unanimously. People like Ted Kennedy were backing it. But then you go to the late 90s, and, you know, almost the same question with the Religious Liberty Protection Act, and much more muted support, able to pass only a very attenuated version on that occasion. And so you began to see at that time the effect of the, you know, the conflict, I think, between gay rights and religious liberty.
Mm-hmm. I think you meant to say the late 2000s. You said late 1990s.
Well, that, I'm saying that's kind of the genesis. That's kind of where it starts.
Okay, yeah.
And then, you know, now it's absolutely bearing fruit everywhere,
yeah.
Right? You know, and I mean, as we record this podcast, we're watching a controversy unfold in which Tony Dungy dared to say that he probably would not have drafted Michael Sam.
Yeah, and I should note that we are recording this on July 23rd, so we'll be airing it in a few weeks. But so for those of you saying, Tony Dungy, who's he? He's in the news right now, might not be in the news in 2 weeks.
Former coach of the Indianapolis Colts when they won the Super Bowl with Peyton Manning.
Mm-hmm. That they did. And I should remind everybody that Seattle Seahawks destroyed Peyton Manning in Super Bowl 48. But
I have to, you know, Tony, just since you love your Seahawks so much, I have to say that that was the most shocking Super Bowl result that I have ever seen.
Shocking in a good way. With all due respect to my friend, to my fans in Denver, so... Anyway, we're back to the point.
Yes.
The question is, what is happening over the last decade or so? What shifts are we seeing? Is there a movement away from the religious right? You mentioned their heyday was roughly around 2005, the pinnacle. And then I guess after you hit that pinnacle, it's downhill. Is this coalition unraveling? Is there a future for it? And again, come back to that question, is there a connection with the Tea Party?
Yes. Well, I'd say this. I would say that that prior to the last few years, the religious right always had kind of a this powerful moral capital on its side as the pro-life group. I think that the pro-life cause has actually become very strong. If you were to look at young people's attitudes, I think they are very much more pro-life now than they were in the past. So I think that crusade has succeeded in a lot of ways. Now, obviously not legally. It has not prevailed by overturning Roe v. Wade, although that may eventually happen. I think it actually will eventually happen. But when the focus shifted from the life issue, from kind of this bioethical view, to this question of the nature of marriage, I think that the momentum just has gone strongly against the religious right in that area. And just because there is Americans are very moved by appeals to equality. The movement for gay rights has been able to very effectively, put things in terms of a quest for equality, and Americans, generally speaking, are not in any mood to really resist that. And as religious conservatives feel that they must continue to oppose it, and very vigorously, they're going to continue to struggle with a lot of unpopularity. Now, you know, hey, that's the nature of religious conviction, right? You don't change based on the polls.
It's interesting that you talk about that issue as being a fulcrum point, I think, for the movement, in that if you go back to 2004, 2005, you're looking at a lot of referendums or initiatives in the states about same-sex marriage, and they went down pretty handily.
Right.
But there was just a tectonic shift in public attitudes, it seems to me, over the past 10 years on this issue, and in part is that every time an initiative was passed banning same-sex marriage or defining marriages between a man and a woman, all of a sudden the court would step in and say, no, we're overturning that. And this happened again and again. In fact, it's still happening this year. You see it in Utah and a few other, I think Oklahoma as well. And then all of a sudden it just seems like everybody says, you know what, we don't want to fight this battle anymore. That's fine. I mean, I think if you took initiatives across the United States, state by state now, I don't think same-sex marriage bans would actually pass.
Well, I think that what happened is that between the courts and the media, the accepted narrative is that the only reason you could ever oppose gay marriage is because either you hate gay people or because you have a religious reason for opposing gay marriage, and how dare you ever bind anyone else on the basis of your religious beliefs? So if the debate proceeds in that way, well, you know, fine. People will eventually come to the view that hey, you're a superstitious and mean person who opposes gay marriage. Now you know why that would be dominant. You know, I don't understand why it's not sort of an equally compelling view to say, hey, you know, let's look at the simple complementarity of the sexes. You know, while you may disagree with whether the complementarity of the sexes should sort of dictate the shape of marriage, it's hardly irrational to think that the complementarity of the sexes should be a very big point in all of this. And yet, somehow we've come to a point where the fundamental complementarity of the sexes matters not at all.
Mm-hmm. So that is an issue that has changed the dynamics of the religious right movement, or has at least affected it quite a bit. I'm going to come back to that issue of the Tea Party, though, because there seems to be the new conservative populism. And many people would argue that the Tea Party tends to have a very libertarian slant to it, getting to economic free market issues, and government is too big, let's deregulate everything, issues that the religious right really hasn't been big upon. And as you mentioned, there's maybe been a tension within the Republican Party in the past. So is there any kind of tension or relationship between the religious right and the Tea Party?
Yeah, no question. I think that the reason that the Tea Party has become more and more of an issue in relationship to the religious right has to do with the question you asked me about the future of the religious right. And, you know, and earlier on, you said something about the degree to which the religious right has been personality-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about, you know, people like Schaefer or Colson or Dobson or Falwell or Robertson. Or Newhouse, and we could even throw in William F. Buckley in there as a conservative Catholic. And the thing is, we have other than Robertson, we have lost all of these people. They have all died. Now they have left behind them a deeper bench. Okay, there are more people in office who take these things seriously, I think. There are more people who are academics who take these things seriously than there would have been in the past. So I guess what I would say is there are a lot of people who are not necessarily big names, big leaders, who have been affected by these folks, but they have not been successful in kind of replicating themselves. The biggest name that I can think of in what I might call the religious right now is Robert George, who I know that you have just interviewed.
Yep, he was on last week. Yep.
Robert George is a professor at Princeton. He is not going to be leading big crowds with pitchforks, right? not that that's what would be desirable, but the point is that he's not going to kind of, you know, build a mass movement. That's not his game, right? You know, he is he is carrying on the conversation at a very high level. Now, you know, the other person who I think comes closest, and who maybe there's a lot of hope around this guy, is Russell Moore. Russell Moore is the new head of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And the interesting thing about Russ is, and he's a professor, a theologian, but he really has the common touch. And not only that, and this affects the Tea Party thing, Russ Moore is a former staffer for a Democrat congressman in Mississippi. So Russ's views on economics probably are a little bit more populist, you know, a little bit more center, maybe even slightly left of center. And the thing that's good about that is that maybe he can bring back the appeal of some of these cultural issues with folks who have determined their view of everything on the basis of economics. Now, Tea Party, religious right, what's the connection? The answer is, I don't think there really is a connection. The Tea Party really is fundamentally kind of a libertarian movement. It's a movement that has to do with, you know, the size of government is too big, we're spending too much money. I think that's what the Tea Party is all about. Those are not really predominant religious right concerns, and to the degree that the religious right gets dragged into it, I think a lot of it is just because the left wants to counter the Tea Party. In the Tea Party, they see a spontaneous movement rapidly growing and being built, and they're like, how are we going to deflate this thing? And so they call it racist, and they call it religious, and they try to make it look like a negative thing to be associated with it, and therefore to take the wind out of its sails.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about, you mentioned new leaders and new ideas amongst the evangelical community and things. One of the things that you take up in your book, The System Has a Soul, are writings of James Davison Hunter and then also related Jonathan Malesic, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly. And they've taken a much different view on the engagement of religion in public life. Explain that a little bit and tell me what your reaction to that is.
Sure. Jonathan, it's either Malesic or Malesic. I'll call him Malesic. John is a Catholic theologian, and he and I had an extended debate in the pages of the Journal of Markets and Morality on the question of whether secularism is kind of the appropriate pose for Christians to adopt with regard to the public square. He actually thinks that Christians should adopt secularism, and he thinks the reason to do so is that it's actually virtuous to do so. He thinks that Christians are now try to use their religious identity for economic advantage. He has a very cynical view of public Christianity. He thinks that when people engage in public Christianity, it's usually with some sort of market-driven goal in mind. And so he thinks that Christians need to just kind of totally back off. He would be in favor of almost kind of like a secret Christianity. In fact, I think his book has a title that is close to that, something about secret Christianity, that we essentially need to just back off and be quiet. And this is sort of the tie-in with James Davison Hunter. James Davison Hunter says we need to be silent for a season. So both of them feel like we have been maybe too vocal, too noisy, have attracted a lot of negative attention, and it's time to back off. Now that doesn't forestall some resurgence at a later time, but that's what both of them are kind of saying.
Now, how does that relate to, you know, what Chuck Colson was saying in the 1970s, that you got to take your Christianity and make it public. Let's not hide it on Sundays, activate it only on Sundays at 10 a.m., but really take it out to the world. Is there that tension here? And how much is the stuff of Malesic and Hunter really resonating?
I think that it's resonating a lot with younger people. I think that, You know, I think that for earlier generations, that Colson-like impetus was really strong. There was a big, big push, and certainly I have been involved in this, very, very big push to bring your faith into all of life, right? To have kind of a very disciplined and holistic approach of integrating your faith in life. In fact, you look at the word integrity, you know, it has to do with integration. Whitaker Chambers talks about a communist in his book Witness as being the most integrated person I ever met. You know, that's kind of the approach that Colson was pushing. With Milicic and James Davison Hunter, I can kind of understand what they're saying. You know, the thing is that I think that David Martin, the sociologist, has pointed this out. If Christianity does not interfere with the sort of the natural order, right, with the you know, kind of government capitalism nexus, you know, whatever sort of the powers that be want, if Christianity doesn't interfere with that, if it kind of goes along with it, then maybe the church, and Tony, this relates to your writing, then maybe the church kind of gets to be allowed to continue as sort of the, you know, the formal blesser of all that the state does, right? You know, it kind of gets to maintain this kind of heightened status as long as it goes along. What we have seen during the past 30 to 40 years is that Christians have been, they have not been doing that. They have been making very clear their disagreements. They have been pushing for a different view of things than kind of what the establishment might want. The way that Schaefer would put it is that we've been sharpening the antithesis, right? We've been making it very clear what our differences are. And when you do that, then more people are going to look at you and say, hey, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with you, right? And so you develop enemies. And I think that people like Hunter and Milicic are kind of saying, hey, it's time to back off of that for a while. Maybe we have played that strategy out, and we have to do something different.
Yeah, I'm wondering to what extent that is going to occur. You take a historical perspective. Once again, we started with a deeper historical perspective to begin this interview with, and might want to end with one here, that there have been these waves. You look back in American history, you have the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, the Fundamentalist Revival, the you know, burned out districts, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe we're in that part of the cycle now where Christianity is, I guess, moving back into the shadows a little bit or becoming a little bit more secret, maybe to revive again. What's your thoughts on the future of where all this is headed?
I think that I don't think it's going to move into the shadows, but I think that the emphasis is going to change significantly in terms of what we are pressing for. I think that before Christians were pushing for sort of a Christianized politics and culture. They wanted to kind of go for the whole banana. You know, let's redeem this whole thing. Let's make it all better. Let's make it demonstrate the lordship of Christ, and that will be a good society. And I think that what's happening now with the extraordinary counter pressure that is coming to bear, I think that Christians will be increasingly influenced to adopt a libertarian approach. I mean, you look at things like the way the gay marriage agenda is advancing. Christians are going to increasingly advocate for the freedom to be Christian, you know, the freedom to be a Christian businessman who has a particular view of things, the freedom to be a Christian college that has a particular view of bioethics, and you should tolerate our existence and our desire to have a different view of these things. That is more of a defensive and libertarian pose than it would be kind of a let's transform America pose.
And that is very fascinating because we see that crystallizing in many ways in the recent Hobby Lobby versus Sebelius decision.
Yes.
Yeah. I can see where that's possibly happening here. And any last thoughts that you, to return to James Davison Hunter, which you write about him in your book quite a bit, and you also deal with the libertarian question, and love to talk more about that over possibly another podcast. We're running a little bit out of time here, but this issue about James Davison Hunter. First of all, you're not related to James Davison Hunter, are you?
Well, that would be his last name and my middle name, so no.
Hunter is your middle name?
Hunter is my middle name.
What was your first name?
Hunter Baker.
What's your first name? What is your first name?
Terry.
Oh, so you go by Hunter. I didn't know that. I've always
my dad is Terry.
Oh, okay.
So I'm Hunter, yes.
Okay. So you're not related to him.
With regard to the author you mentioned, James Davison Hunter, the interesting thing about that book is he spends the whole book kind of talking about why we shouldn't try to change the world and why we can't.
And I should note that the name of the book is To Change the World.
That's right.
Right.
But the interesting thing is that he tells you how to do it.
Mm.
He tells you how to change the world. You know, he kind of explains how people like Jews or gays have exerted a very outside influence on culture. You know, you look at Jews, a very, very tiny part of the population. There are only 13 million Jews, I think, in the entire world, and we're talking about a world with billions of people. And so the influence they've been able to exert, the impact they've been able to have on culture is absolutely gigantic. You look at homosexuals, again, you're a marginalized group, a group with not all that many people, but has been able to have a very big impact. And he kind of analyzes how that's the case. And one of the big points that he makes is that you have to penetrate elite culture, and you have to do it at the centers, not at the periphery. It's not good enough to be, in Colorado Springs, like Focus on the Family. You know, you got to be in New York. You got to be in L.A., and you have to be interacting, and of course Washington, and you got to be interacting at an elite level. You could argue that people like Luther and Calvin are elites of sorts. Certainly the Apostle Paul is an elite of sorts. So there needs to be, we need to find a way to penetrate those elite circles in the center areas. And, you know, there are a lot of Christians who have been working on that, but a lot of those efforts are kind of nascent.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. For me, that's a very interesting and challenging point, because I'm somewhat, in many ways, the opposite. I tend to be very populist in many regards and look to the peripheries and changing people at the grassroots rather than at the elite centers, where I'm not necessarily all that comfortable all the time. But very interesting. Your thoughts on whether that's going to be successful in the future? You say it's nascent, but I don't know.
I kind of believe in the... I believe that the fortunes of Christianity tend to kind of wax and wane.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we have been through a period where it waxed and had a pretty big influence, did a lot of things, and I think that right now we're in one of those downward cycles. I think we're going to be back, and I also would bet on the greater unity of the church in the future, and that's going to help too.
Well, historically, that seems to bear itself out, that there are those waxing and waning periods, and we'll see if we are in a waning period. But I have to admit, I have to say, that there is one other way to change the world other than piercing the elite structures, and that is to get a puppy. And so I bring us back to the very first part of our conversation, is when are you going to get that puppy dog for your family?
It would at least change my world. It would change my world in such a way that there was a lot more cleaning up of poop.
Yeah. And that isn't necessarily bad, because in many ways, that is what us academics and Christians should be doing, is cleaning up a lot of poop. My guest today has been Hunter Baker. Hunter, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.